Hey, everybody, and welcome to this week's edition of the Mostly Mets podcast, where we talk mostly about the Mets. This is our annual draft review. We'll have Jim Callis, senior writer for MLB.com and MLBPipeline.com. But first, we have all of the David Wright news. I'm Toby Hyde with Matt Cerrone this week, filling in for Rob Brender. Matt, how are you?
I'm doing good. I guess I'm doing physically better than David Wright. Tough news. I feel bad for the guy. You know, I do. Can't feel too bad. You know, he's got a good, you know, he's happily married. He's got a good situation, made a ton of money. I think he'll be fine. If he comes back and plays baseball, that will be great. But, you know, it just stinks. It stinks for him physically. It's like, you know, you want to play baseball and you can't. And, you know, I guess he's facing some decisions here that maybe sooner than he probably expected.
Right. So the news Thursday, he's going to have surgery Thursday to repair a herniated disc, really in his neck, which is different than spinal stenosis. Yes. And generally this thing takes about 3 months. So you can do the math. We're in the middle of June. So July, August, September, and that's in a best case scenario. So his 2016 season's probably done.
Yeah. The other concern is, and I guess we'll find this out, you know, they say there's obviously no link, no connection between the lumbar spinal stenosis and the herniated disc, which I know firsthand is accurate, but, you know, my concern for him is what kind of setback does the lower back have in terms of his inability to rehab and do certain things because he's resting the surgery from the herniated disc, and how does that sort of snowball? So he's got a lot on his plate. He's got a lot of decisions to make. I'm not suggesting he's going to retire, but, you know, if he can't come back and be a contributing player and do the things he wants to do, you know, you wonder at what point does he start having to have those serious thoughts. I know from talking to him that, you know, that went through his mind last summer. You got to think it's going through his mind again, and it's going to go through his mind in a more real way, you know, say a year from now when it's just not happening for him on field. So that's kind of where he's at. Hopefully he gets back and he can make this work and he can be a, you know, serviceable player. But, you know, I think of Don Mattingly, and that's like the first thing that comes to mind. It's like the Yankees made the playoffs, Mattingly got a sniff, he went away, and that was it. And like that, I hate to think that's David Wright's story.
A couple of things that you said there that I want to follow up on. The connection between this herniated disc in the neck and the lower back and the spinal stenosis. I mean, usually we have to, you know, make a joke about like when a guy pulls his hamstring, he's got tight lower back, like a young Jose Reyes, you know, that the leg bone is connected to the backbone. I mean, here we don't even have to make that joke, right? It's all the same spinal column. Do you have any feel for the medicine and how these things might be related? If they are at all, I mean, but it just seems like it's so close and the back has to work so well all together that it seems like there should be a connection. Do you have any feel for the medicine on this?
Well, they are two different conditions, even though they are, you know, essentially the same part of the body. You know, the lower and the upper, it's going to be two different kinds of things. I think the discs are going in two different directions. What's causing the stenosis is one issue. What's causing the herniated disc is another. So I don't know that there's overlap there, but, you know, you can have, and again, just from my own experience with this, you can have, you know, arthritis and different things going on in your spine that cause a lot of other stuff that aren't necessarily related. So, I mean, who knows what's happening? And frankly, we may never know that. And he may not know that, but the fact of the matter is he clearly has spinal issues. I mean, there's just no getting around that. Those are the facts. And that's not an easy thing for a baseball player, you know, giving kinesiology, all these little things, how everything ties together in terms of your mechanics and pain and how you manage your body over the course of a season. I mean, this is not easy. It's not going to be an easy thing for him. And he's not getting younger. It's only going to get harder. And you know, you look at it and you think, I don't know. Again, I mentioned Mattingly because that's, you know, Donnie was never really shut down by anything very specific. It was just the collective of this isn't working anymore, and that's that.
Right, his body just couldn't go. Yeah. You've mentioned it twice. I know you've had back problems. I watched my dad fight back problems, and they just sort of come and go. But can you sort of – can? And I know you're not David Wright, and you're not a professional athlete, but can you give someone who hasn't suffered through it some of the degree of sort of pain and frustration that goes with it? Can you explain some of that?
Yeah, it's a weird thing. I mean,
And explain what you had, because I know.
Yeah, sure. I have rheumatoid arthritis throughout, and particularly in my spine and my lower back, and that's what's causing the collapse of the disc. So I do, depending on the positioning, I will, you know, the disc will press on a nerve, and that feeling is terrible. You know, it's numbness, it's lack of control. It's just a very, I can't imagine having to try and stand in a batter's box and hit a 90 mile an hour fastball feeling that way. I don't know how anybody could do it. And so, I mean, the rehab and the programs that he's involved in are world class. And obviously, just to be able to get back on the field and do the little bit that he's been able to do is in some ways an accomplishment. But then you throw in the herniated disc, and if that, which I don't think is, because they haven't reported this, and I don't know for a fact that it's not the case, but if that is touching a nerve, that makes playing baseball almost impossible, because now you're losing, you know, you're going to lose control over your upper body and grip, and you know, it's going to be impossible. I don't know if that's the case with him, and I don't want to say that it is, but if it is, it's you know, good night.
All right, so news bound on David Wright. So again, he's out for the 2016 season, and I think we'll know a little more medically after the surgery is performed. Yes. The Mets were resistant to put a timetable before he went under the knife. So after Thursday's procedure in California, we'll have some more. So apologies for when you're listening to this, but we're recording it early Thursday afternoon before we have that information. So we'll have a little more after that. But this does clarify a little bit the Mets roster for the rest of the season and some of their needs, does it not, Matt?
Yeah, you know,
I hate to shift.
I mean, absolutely, it's baseball.
Do you have more stuff on David Wright's med? But my point of introducing the surgery timeline was we don't know the full medical details yet, but we do know that this Mets roster is going to miss David Wright for the rest of the year.
Well, the fact of the matter is they have missed him for most of the last 2 years. And so they're, as far as on field, they're pretty accustomed to, you know, they're used to dealing with this, right? They've got Wilmer Flores who can play third base. Personally, I think he's more useful kind of rotating around the diamond, you know, but they can use him there. And if, and look, third base is not an easy position to acquire. And there certainly aren't a lot of teams shopping third baseman, that's for certain. So, you know, that's going to make it difficult. And so it may just be the kind of thing where it's Kelly Johnson, it's Wilmer Flores, it's Reynolds, it's, you know, maybe someone else they pick up. I don't know that they're going to find that solution this season. And they kind of knew, they had to know that was coming. It was a possibility in spring training because you didn't know what David Wright was going to be capable of doing. So it's been on their minds as a front office now for years. That's on field. Off field, in the clubhouse and all that, you know, his leadership is important and all that stuff is important, but that has also waned over the last few years. It has shifted from his team to other people. You've had some of these young players come up and really take ownership. Kelly Johnson is really, you know, now on his second stint, his second tour, you know, he really plays a role, that type of role in the clubhouse, even though he doesn't have the track record necessarily or the homegrown, you know, nature of being a New York Met that Wright had. But he's still, you know, these young guys know him. So, you know, he I think that's going to be a collective of all those guys. And again, like I said, this isn't a new problem. It's been going on for years.
Right. I mean, I still think the play is Dilson Herrera comes up, plays second, Walker plays third every day, and Wilmer Flores and James Loney split first base, and Wilmer goes back to his roving role.
Yep. It very easily could be that. You know, there's a lot of options. They have options. No, they're not ideal options, but they are options.
And by the way, we can plug last week's show. Rob and I did a show with Jerry Krasnick sort of looking at trade options around baseball at second and third base, and there just aren't very many at this time of year. Okay, so that's sort of the news at the big league level, which is a little ominous right now. But Matt, let's have a conversation about the future. We'll get to Jim Callis in a moment. But before we get to the draft, a quick note, definitely check out Inside the Park with Steve Gelbs and the new podcast from SNY.TV, where Steve profiles Met second baseman Neil Walker and shares some great insight on the Walker family's connections to Roberto Clemente. You got to hear all that. And Matt, tell us about your Mets blog Q&A cast that'll post on Friday.
That's interesting. I talked to this guy, Kyle Flaherty. He's got, he developed an offensive baseball statistic that, you know, it's not typically my cup of tea, but this one I found interesting because it really puts an emphasis on late and close at bats and the context of the situation and the context of the team and all these things. And it was interesting to have this conversation with him about it. He calls it a sit metrics. The site is pretty solid. And, you know, so we have a whole conversation about, you know, about the statistic, but also as it pertains to the Mets and what maybe they need, particularly, you know, this summer as we get closer to the trade deadline, what are some of the things that they should be doing through the prism of this statistic? So it's a good conversation. I think people enjoy it.
The old high leverage debate.
Bingo.
Good. All right. So I will definitely check that out on Friday. Yeah.
Yeah, it looks like it. Yep.
Okay, so, and then for the football folks, there's a new episode of the Jets Blog podcast feature former Jet and current SNY analyst Eric Coleman, along with Corey Griffin and Brian Bassett. That show covers all the latest news out of minicamp. Remember, for all of these original podcasts, just subscribe to the SNY.TV audio network on iTunes or wherever you listen to your podcasts. That's the SNY.TV audio network, and please make sure to rate and review the channel and the show. So, Jim Callis is the senior writer for MLB.com and MLBPipeline.com. He has slept very little in the last week covering the Major League Baseball draft. So, Jim, how are you?
Doing good. Trying to recover from the draft. Went from draft, like, kind of projections and analysis to now draft signings. But, I that'll start to slow down soon, and then it's off to the College World Series, which I always enjoy.
All right, so the shape of this Mets draft, a couple pitchers from Long Island early, a lot of college players, some shortstops. What is your overall impression of this class? I know the draft day grades don't mean a whole lot, but what do you see in this class?
The Mets class or the class as a whole?
The Mets class.
I thought, obviously heavy college-oriented. I don't think they took the first high school guy until round 11, but, it doesn't stand out for me. Like, but that's also a good thing, too. I mean, they got guys, I think, where they were supposed to go. I mean, Justin Dunn, the 19th overall pick, and there's a lot of talk he was going to go to Seattle 11, and I thought he would have if Kyle Lewis hadn't kind of surprisingly fallen to them. But I think he was a good value at 19. And Anthony Kay, there was a lot of talk he could go 31. And Peter Alonso, I thought was a second or third rounder. And Blake Tiberi, I thought was a third to fifth rounder. Michael Pias maybe went a little bit earlier than I thought. But then Colby Woodmansee went a little later than I thought. So, at least for me, when I'm looking at a draft, like right after it happened, I look at kind of value for where guys were supposed to go. And I thought the Mets guys, for the most part, they took the guys where they were supposed to go.
So Justin Dunn, 19th overall pick out of Boston College. We've seen some of the cute video of him celebrating with his teammates. He has some shortstop in his background, so he shares a lot with a lot of these Mets, it seems like. And he's close to home. But what kind of pitcher can he be if it all works out?
Yeah, he opened the year in the bullpen and then wound up getting in the rotation. And just, the more guys saw him, he's one of those guys, every time I talk to somebody, it's like his stock rose and rose and rose. Like, he wasn't really on my radar. I don't do the Northeast. Jonathan Mayo does that for us. So it wasn't really a guy I was bearing down on. And I was like, this guy could go in the top two rounds. And, hey, might go in the sandwich round, might go in the first round. And it was like, this guy might go in the top 10. He's super athletic. The arm's quick. It's low 90s. He can hit 97. Tight slider. He's got to work on the changeup some. But, it's looked pretty good. I think this guy's a legitimate starter. You could see him in the middle of a big league rotation somewhere. Just very, very impressive guy.
Hey, Jim, this is Matt Cerrone. Thanks for coming on with us today.
Sure, no problem.
With their second selection, they took Anthony Kay, who's a left-handed pitcher from Long Island. It's interesting. He went to the same school as Matt, then to UConn. And the thing I love is that this is actually the second time the Mets drafted him. What do you think it is about him that they obviously like about him?
I just think this guy can really, really pitch. I mean, he's not the biggest guy in the world. It's kind of an average fastball lot. I mean, he can hit 95, but he has a changeup that's pretty good. I think he needs to improve the breaking ball a little bit. I mean, there's not like a true out pitch with this guy, but he can just really locate his stuff well and really, really pitch. I mean, I've heard some Mark Burley comps on him, which I kind of like. I mean, Burley, I don't know if any Burley's pitch is great as plus, but it seemed like that guy pitched 200 innings year after year after year, and I kind of think that's the same guy with Kay. It's like I said, breaking ball is a little bit slurvy. Maybe you come up with a cutter or something, but he can really, really pitch.
I was glad that Tommy Tanis made the Mets scouting director made the joke that he didn't want to buy plane tickets this spring, so he just drafted local guys on draft night, so it saved me having to make the joke about him.
Yeah, you're right.
Did you see that?
It's like I can't even keep track of conferences anymore. But, I mean, I was going to say Big East, and I know the Big East doesn't exist anymore. I know BC's in the ACC, and I believe Connecticut's in, like, the shell of what used to be the Big East, right?
Right, but I just, it's two local kids. I thought it was funny. And so he made the quip himself, so it saves us all from having him repeat it. But with their third pick, they went beyond, at least, driving distance from New York City, in Peter Alonso out of University of Florida. And he kind of starts this run on college position players. First baseman have to hit. Is Alonso going to hit enough? The Mets have drafted first baseman in the third to sixth round a bunch in the last few years and haven't had a ton of success. thinking your Jace Boyds and Cole Frenzels for your real minor league nuts, and Dom Smith, obviously, in Double-A and a first-round guys. So I was thinking more about the mid-round guys. But is Alonzo sort of that first base college profile is a little tricky. Is Alonzo appreciably better and has a better chance to succeed than some of those other guys?
Yeah, I mean, I like Alonzo, and you might be, you know, you might be underestimating how far Tommy drove, because if, you know, if he just headed south, you could, like, stop in Louisville, then, you know, get to Barry, then
right.
Go down to Coastal Carolina for Pius, and then continue on to Gainesville, get Pete Alonzo. I mean, I doubt he drove out to Arizona State to see Colby Woodmansee or Chris Vile at Stanford, but he might have kept going down the Atlantic coast and then caught all those guys. But yeah, with Alonzo, I do like him. I don't know if you guys saw the other day, he had a hand injury toward the end of the year.
Yeah.
Came back and hit two balls in the trees in a regional game, first game back. Yeah, I don't think this is like a 25 or 30 power, home run power type of guy. But I mean, I could see this guy, you know, 270, you know, 20 home run type. You know, I think he's got some talent there. I like Pete Alonzo. Your listeners can get another peek at him. He'll be in the College World Series, which starts this weekend. You know, hit well with Wood in the Northwoods League 2 years ago, not as much in the Cape Cod League last year. But he's got some pop. You know, I think the question on him, you know, how much is it strength, how much of it is his bat speed, but he does have some pop.
Can you explain why the strength bat speed dynamic matters for the listeners quickly?
Yeah, it's like, as you go up the ladder and you face better pitching and guys who throw harder, if you need the bat speed to catch up to those pitches and be able to turn on them and do what you want. If it's, you know, it's one thing, you know, and you obviously face good competition at Florida and the SEC, but it, you know, it's one thing if you have more strength of bat speed, and that's, you know, some guys think that may be the case with Alonzo. Like, okay, you're overpowering guys who are throwing 90 miles an hour, but what are you going to do when you get to the big leagues and this guy's throwing 95? You know, and I haven't heard people drop the dreaded slider speed bat on him, tag on him, which is, you know, that means you're going to be in real trouble when you get up there. But just guys, you know, the strength does stand out more than the bat speed, it seems.
With the fourth pick, they took Blake Tiberi. You mentioned him earlier. He's another guy I hear people talk about with bat speed, a lot of power potential. It's timely, given all the talk right now about third base with the Mets, with David Wright. He's a college kid. I've seen some people claim he can move quick, I think, through the system, at least as a hitter. Probably be dependent a lot on his fielding. What do you think about Blake and sort of his path to the big leagues and when he might be able to help this team, assuming all goes well for him?
Yeah, I mean, he's a guy, he's more of a contact hitter. I mean, he does have some bat speed, but he has a contact approach. He was the toughest batter to strike out in the Cape Cod League last year. Had similar numbers this year at Louisville. Almost, you know, very rarely swings and misses. You know, the downside on something like that is those guys tend not to walk a lot because they put balls in play. You know, they don't work deep counts because they square balls up. Had only one homer in the Cape last year, although, I mean, he's got, you know, he's 5'11", 200. He drove the ball more this year. You know, he's not a tremendous athlete, but he works hard. So he's more of that adequate third baseman. You know, so he's going to probably need the pop to profile there because I don't think he really fits, you know, as second base or someplace else. I think that, like you said, the bat's advanced. I think the defense needs work, and he's, you know, probably going to need to learn to drive the ball more consistently. So I don't think he's necessarily going to be a super fast to the big league type of guy out of this draft. I mean, Anthony Kay is probably the guy in this class who gets to the big leagues first.
It's funny hearing that description, and I hadn't put it together, but the description of Tiberi is a little like Kevin Pulwecki in terms of offensive approach, contact-oriented guy, was, you know, put it together great numbers in college, and I know different positions. Tiberi's a left-hander, but there's a Mets profile in there. The guy who makes a ton of contact.
Yeah, I mean, Alonzo's a gifted hitter too. I don't think the Mets like guys who swing and miss. Well,
yep.
I mean, people might say, well, of course they don't. Who does? But what
right.
I mean by that is some guys will trade some swing and miss for some power and athleticism and speed.
Yep.
And I think the Mets really focus on guys who make consistent hard contact at the plate. You may be at the expense of a little power or a little athleticism.
So then we get to a spot where you need athleticism on the diamond as we work towards the later rounds. So in the middle rounds, Paul Pius and Colby Woodmansee in the fourth and fifth rounds, separated by about a half foot of height, right? I mean, if not more. Michael Pius goes 5'7", and Woodmansee's like 6'3", maybe even a little more.
Yeah. You know, and Pius, you know, he's got, you know, you can see him in the College World Series too. He'll be interesting. He's got some pop. You know, for a little guy, he has a big swing, so it's more of a power than a contact approach. So he's a little bit different from that Mets profile. He probably is more at the big league level of a second baseman, that offensive second baseman, than a true shortstop. Woodman C, I think Woodman C's got a better chance to stay a shortstop than Paez, but it's not a lock. and he's another one of those extreme contact guys who puts the bat on the ball. With his size, he's got some raw power, so he might have more pop than your typical shortstop. So. Yeah, interesting. They went, three college. I mean, it probably won't work out like this, but I mean, you could have a whole, three quarters of an infield, whole infield with those four picks in a row. You could go Alonso at first, Pius at second, Woodman C at short, and Tiberi at third, conceivably. I mean, and I'm not projecting that as infield of the future, but it's just interesting that they did that.
Certainly positional diversity.
Yeah, exactly.
So we didn't get to my boy, Christopher Vial, the seventh rounder out of Stanford. Just because, another guy who underperformed at Stanford, it seems like that's not an uncommon theme, right? Relative to some of his tools.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's accurate. I mean, they have guys, I mean, they're usually loaded with arms, and I mean, he's an arm strength guy who has trouble throwing strikes, so he didn't pitch a ton there in 3 years, but there have been guys who come out of there with that profile and become, big leaguers. And I mean, shoot, he can hit 97, and it's a power curveball. You just need consistency, but you might have a real nice reliever, if it all comes together for him.
Do you think there was any impact? This is the first draft without Paul D. Podesta. All these guys they all buy into, I think, the same way about doing things. But, I mean, do you feel like there was any difference on this draft versus maybe other ones that he was more involved in now that he's, running the Browns?
No, I mean, I didn't see anything I didn't see anything in particular that jumped out to me as radically different.
Cool.
So we went through a bunch of the top round Mets picks. Jim, do you have a favorite guy outside of the group we talked about? They took a couple high school guys outside of the top 10. But who's your favorite outside of this group?
Well, the guy who intrigues me a little bit, it might be Cameron Plank. And we split up the draft at MLB Pipeline. Me and Jonathan Mayo, and I do have Kentucky as one of my states, and Cameron Plank was a guy whose name came up as a guy who could be interesting. I don't know what his son Billy number is, although typically if you see a guy taken in the 11th round, it means the team feels like they have a good chance to sign him. They're going to take him with their first pick on day three, but 6'4" guy who, and you can see some 88 to 90, but you can also see some 90, 92, and even touch in 96. He's kind of a physical, projectable guy who lacks consistent velocity, and he needs secondary pitches and more strength and all that type of stuff. But people really like the way the arm worked and the frame, so he's very, very interesting.
One of the things about the Mets system is that they've graduated a lot of big leaguers and some very good, especially on the mound, and Michael Conforto in the last few years. The system has thinned out at the upper levels. This draft seems like it's got some pressure on it to restock the farm. Can it, and will it change this? How will it change this year's offseason rankings, if you can project that far?
I don't know if it changes it a ton. I mean, like I said, Justin Dunn's a good prospect, but I don't think any of these guys make our top 100 prospects list right off the bat. So it's not like they're going to boot. Does it add to the depth? It does, but and I'm just eyeballing our rankings. I don't do our Mets rankings, but Justin Dunn to me would be, you'd rank him in their top, 3, 4, 5 prospects. Anthony Kay, maybe fits in that 6 to 10 range. I think he's more of a floor than a ceiling guy. The guys Alonso and Paez and Tiberi and those guys, I mean, they're guys in the team. So, you'll see a number of these guys on their list, but I don't think they're needle movers, if that makes a lot of sense. It adds to depth,
absolutely,
but you're not going to be like, oh, man, it's not like the Braves who got 3 of the top 8 high school pitchers in the draft, and you're like, okay, these guys are really going to move the needle. I think the Mets had a nice draft, but I don't think it's like going to affect the rankings drastically.
Sure, but barring someone going bonkers this summer or something. But, yeah, makes a lot of sense. Is there one more draft? Let's move beyond the Mets. Is there a draft theme that you think is really important to this year's group, whether it's on the class itself or as we approach signing period? What's the angle that you think is interesting?
For the
Mets? No, for the system broadly, or for baseball, or your sort of big draft story at the moment.
Well, I mean, I guess the one that people are asking me a lot about is, you know, can the Red Sox sign Jason Groom at 12? I mean, he was our top-ranked prospect, and the Padres apparently had promised him $5 million if he got to the 24th pick, which he didn't. And so I seem to get a number of questions via Twitter or email. Hey, are they going to be able to sign this guy? And I think they will in the end. But, it was kind of an interesting draft. I mean, high school pitching was a story, and you wonder, are these guys going to get taken as high as they deserve to go? And for the most part, they did. And the guys who've signed so far and are getting paid. So, I thought that was kind of the story of the draft. That was really the strength of the draft.
Jim Callis writes for senior writer for MLB.com and MLBpipeline.com. No one knows more about the draft and minor league ball than Jim. Jim, thanks so much for the time. We appreciate it.
Yeah, good talking to you guys.
Again, big thanks to Jim Callis. I don't have a ton more to add, but obviously Justin Dunn, the first pick by the Mets, 19th overall, is the guy to watch here, Matt, don't you think?
Yeah, absolutely. And also Anthony Kay sounds really interesting. Could be, like you said, the first one to actually get to the big leagues. They've traded a lot of those pitchers away, and they promoted guys, so it's time to bring some new blood into the system, and hopefully this is the start of that.
So hopefully we gave you a little balance this week, some really sad news about David Wright. I think all Mets fans are David Wright fans. At least I hope so, but anyway. And then a look towards the future and some optimism. Matt, thanks so much for hanging out today.
Absolutely.
For Matt Cerrone, big thanks to Jim Callis. I'm Toby Hyde. This has been the Mostly Mets Podcast. We'll see you next week.
This has been the Mostly Mets Podcast, part of the SNY.TV Audio Network.